The talk tonight is really about how and why do I become somebody. It's less about this mystery of that we talked about before of well, I can't be really sure that I'm somebody, but I'm also not nobody. And the paradox of that place. So now I want to talk tonight a little bit about what's called in the Buddhist tradition bhava, meaning becoming, the process of arriving into the sense of self. And I think that we really need to start off with the understanding of sankharas. Sankharas are basically constructions or forms, tendencies, patterns, habits, shapes, all of which are kind of created through conditions and through believing those conditions to be shaping me. So I'm the result of conditions, but I take them on and I become the result of conditions. It's obvious when you think of, I don't know, your parents, society, conditions say that you're Israeli, and you absolutely believe it. And it's not a question. Someone says, who are you? What do you say? It's just all the millions and millions of beliefs that we have about ourselves are sankharas, conditions or constructions. And one big one that sort of covers them all, kind of the elephant in the room, is the construction of me and myself in all its glory and craziness. And so it's the biggest construction of them all. And it kind of collects together loads and loads of other smaller constructions under one big roof. One big canyon, you almost can say. And what we don't usually see is how we allowed that to happen. How we got stuck with that conviction that we don't question. That I am me, I am this, I am that, I believe, my views, my needs, what I think my life should be, where who am I, my identity. We don't really see the way that the thing has grown in us from childhood. And there's a lot of dependence that we have, klut, on everything, on our life, on our food, on our, what we need to be alive. And because of that dependence, we have this need for being. And it's automatic. And we struggle to be. And from there comes all the constructions around that I need to be. I need to sort out life so I am, so I'm okay. Actually, you know, we're all here to, in a way, to find freedom. But freedom, as we were hearing today in one of our groups, is the most scary thing. We're actually really scared of freedom. We're really scared of silence. We mostly fill our lives so that there isn't any silence. We have plenty of freedom. We have plenty of silence. We have plenty of emptiness. But it's the last thing we want. We pack up our life so that we make sure there's no emptiness, no silence, and no freedom. And then we have to come to a retreat to kind of try and get a little bit of it back again. But if we get too much, if suddenly this total emptiness, nothingness kind of landed on us, we'd freak out very fast. The Buddha had a beautiful sermon, a beautiful speech, and it's one of the most radical speeches. I mean, mostly he was very radical, but this is one of the most radical. And it's this, the fire, the speech or the sermon of fire, when he pointed out how much we are totally addicted to activity. And it's in the deepest level of our psychology. And he said, the eye is burning, the ear is burning, the other senses, the mind is burning. We're on fire. We're on fire with processing everything, with needing, with the eye consciousness is constantly looking, checking, wanting, making sure we're safe, making sure it's okay, making sure there's no threat, making sure we're happy, making sure that the food is good, making sure it's not good, that they're getting upset that it's matzah and not bread and everything. This is the eye. And it doesn't stop the moment even in the night. It doesn't stop. Every one of our senses, our whole being, is frantically busy trying to get life right and safe. And the Buddha called it fire. And I think we can see it today with billions of human beings doing all of that. We're burning up the planet. And we can't stop. There's no way we can stop. I just don't see any way that anyone's stopping it. And the burning is basically called craving, is our craving, is our hitsamduyot, attachments. It's called in the Pali upadana. And upadana, why the Buddha said the fire, is because upadana is also described as fuel for the fire. So the attachment is like fuel for the fire. It's the same word, attachment, and also fuel. In other words, what is it that we feed? What do we feed in us, or in the world, or in us, our life? And that's a more subtle form of attachment. It's not simple psychological attachment. It's what is it that we're feeding all the time in our life? And the Buddha took it to that place. It's fuel to the fire. We're feeding our fires. Our fires of restlessness, of heat, of activity, intensity, trying to get ourselves comfortable and so on. And a big attachment, of course, is to me. And by the way, non-attachment, which is the third noble truth, is Nibbana. Awakening. Awakening simply means, Nibbana simply means putting out the fires. We put out the fires because they don't have any fuel anymore. That's simply Nibbana. We make it into a huge thing. Enlightenment, awakening is like God. But actually all it means is putting out the fire. So, attachment is what keeps this thing going. Craving, attachment, hitsamduyot, and everything that goes with it. A couple of years ago, I was in California, and I was amazed on Route 101, driving there a lot, and the famous Route 101. Along the bay, San Francisco Bay, and there was a huge, huge poster, which is giant, with a hamburger, and it was a McDonald's advert, and it said, "We craft it for your craving." I was amazed, so I wanted to take it and put it in. So just this is the fuel. This is the fuel. And it leads us on very much like a kind of a stick on the back of a donkey with a carrot in front. that the donkey goes on because it's wanting the carrot. And the craving is like that. It makes us, we crave for, it makes us ambition, need, wanting to get on, to be successful, to be, have lots of money, to be comfortable. Like I said, it's always leading us on. It's always propelling us forward. It's always making us something or somebody that we need to be in order to satisfy these needs. So the self is basically built from craving, from, and craving or need to collect together into a person. And it's a little bit subtle here, but I think that if we look carefully at our experience, we see that it's made of many other things. We ourselves are made of many experiences. And this many experiences and impressions, I think I put a quote from Jacob Needleman on the board outside showing this, that we are made of millions of impressions, consciousness, thoughts, memories, needs, body, physical, mind, body. We're made of many, many things, and every experience is made of many, many things. But we don't know that. So we put them all together in a lump called me. And I just want to quote a Buddhist text here where Mara, who is the kind of challenge to the awakening, Mara is always sort of Satra Acha, the other side, that comes with a voice saying, you don't need to practice, just be where you are, just be full of craving, is all right, what's the problem, stay where you are, you're okay, you don't need, you know. It's always the voice. That the Buddha, by the way, was, all his life, Mara arrived, never stopped. It's not that when he reached awakening, every challenge and every voice of any doubt or any negative thought or whatever just simply vanished. It wasn't the case. All his life, Mara appeared again and again, but it was immediately seen as Mara. In other words, Mara was dealt with, but it arises. And I think it's a good lesson for us that we may have issues that are sticky. For example, a psychological pattern or woundedness from our childhood, and we really want to wipe it out, but we actually don't need to wipe it out. We just need to keep seeing it. It may be with us all our life, but it just gets less and less interesting and less of a problem. But we can't wipe it out. It's a illusion to think we can kind of wipe our history. So anyway, along comes Mara and says, who made this human being? By whom was it created? Where is the maker of a human being? Where did a human being come from? Where does a human being go to? And this lady, woman, nun, and by the way, in the early Buddhism there are plenty of women as well, seems very male often, but it's actually not. And Sister Vajira said, Mara, what's going on? Do you assume a being? You assume a being. When you say a being was, how was it created? You have a basic assumption that there is a being. How can you take that position that there is a being? This is purely a pile of constructions. Here, no living being can be pinned down, can be identified. Just as when you take all the pieces together, you have a word called chariot, car. Even so, when all the pieces together, there's a convention of a being. It's a convention. But actually, there's only dukkha is what comes to be, and dukkha what stays and falls away. Nothing comes, nothing arises but dukkha, and nothing stops but dukkha. In other words, the pain of this experience of being in the world and ending of that. So, we define ourselves as a being, we defend ourselves as a being, we create a difference between us and the other, all of which is attachment, craving to be, craving and needing, the survival need, making these dualities in the world. Me and the world. They can't be there ultimately. There cannot be duality in life. Where can you cut life? As Rumi once said, how can you take water out of water? How can water look at water and think it's something else? Like the old Indian story of a grain of salt that was trying to understand what salt is like. And I don't know who said, someone said to the grain of salt, well, just jump in the sea and you'll know what salty is like. In other words, just go back to saltiness. Then you'll find out. So we separate ourselves. There isn't any duality in the world, and we make it through our attachment. And basically because we want to be safe and we want to be here forever, stable, safe, protected, alive, comfortable, and that drives the whole thing. Desire, need, craving. I told this story before to some of the group in Tel Aviv, but when I was in India at Varanasi, I was teaching in the Krishnamurti school for a year in Varanasi. And one day I went to the other side of the river, the Varuna, which is a small river and has a little bridge. I went to the other side and talked to some of the people there, the villagers. And I said, what's this place called? They said, Ispar. And I said, what does Ispar mean? And they said, it means over there. I said, well, I'm here, you're here. Not there. But they said, they're relative to there, to the other side, we're over there. Because they're the important ones, they're the school and the Krishnamurti, and we're just the villagers, so they called us over there, so we call ourselves over there. But it's very much not theoretical. It very much causes us, this craving, causes us a great deal of pain and struggle and effort. And I mean, just think how much effort we put into being somebody. How much the narrative in the mind is, I'm not good enough, I need to be more, I need to be ambitious so as to, I need to make sure the future is, I need to, my year, I need to secure the future in some way, I need to all the time, it's super hard work. All the world of fixing, all the psychologists that, well, I better shut up now, before I get myself into trouble. But no, I'm not, you know, it's needed sometimes for sure and valuable and so on. But the intensity around fixing ourselves, the intensity around something's wrong with me that I need to fix. The intensity around, I have to take pills, I have to do it better, I have to go to this, that, the other. I have to control my body, I have to control life, I have to cover the earth with concrete so it's safe, and I have to keep controlling the world and nature and my body, and this intensity, it's really amazing. I mean, when I come from a alternative medicine background, and also in science, and there's some beautiful, very fundamental movements in alternative medicine, which are actually quite forgotten, because alternative medicine has got a little bit captured by modern medicine. But the fundamental act of trust, the healing power inside us. Trust that there is inside us a power that knows what to do. And all that activity of fixing and mending and not right and having to and so on is kind of not trusting that there is a healing power in us, or there is a kind of a okayness in us. And it's quite a disease, especially in the Western world. We all have crises all the time in relationships, in conflict, in violence. And, we have crises between the people closest to us and the family that we should really not have crises, but they are going to be there, and they are there. And it's kind of natural. It's not that we can avoid it. It's not that we can somehow find the perfect relationship. But how much of that is this pain of subject-object, of me that I have to protect myself, that I'm being attacked, or I'm being betrayed, or they don't understand me, or I'm not loved enough, or I'm not paid attention to, or I am rejected, or, you know, it's just so much of it, is so full of it, in just a simple act of being together with a partner, or in a family. And it's all coming from that place of the self standing there and saying, I need conditions, I'm attached to conditions. So it's quite kind of a understandable to come up and say, yeah, but wait a minute. This sense of craving or neediness, dependence, creating a person, becoming, surely I also have wonderful needs and wonderful desires and wonderful becoming. I'm coming to a retreat. So I have a desire, attachment to a retreat. And I'm here, in a way, taking on the role of a Buddhist practitioner. Or I'm taking on the role of Buddhist teacher. As soon as I get off the bum, I take it off again. But I mean, I've got it. So in other words, there is becoming, or a kind of a selfing, which seems very positive. And we shouldn't forget that. And the teaching is really deals with this quite a lot. And the Buddha basically said, choose the best becoming that you can have. It's like a rabbi once told me, Judaism is the best idol worship that I know. Yehudut avodah zarah hachi tov shani yodeh. It's like that. Yes, there's becoming that replaces other sorts of becoming, which are beneficial, and which are helpful, and we can feel it's okay. Like same with desire, there is desire for liberation. It is not wise to pretend that we can wipe out desire. Instead, we can say, yeah, I will direct my desire more and more towards positive directions and make it lighter and lighter. But I can't be under illusion. I can kind of wipe it, finish it. It doesn't work like that. So instead of that, wisely, like in Aikido, like in the dance of Chinese Japanese martial art of we direct the energy to a safer place and a more harmonious place, the energy of becoming. So becoming in the name of practice is a blessed becoming. But in the end you drop that as well. And that's the point. That no, in the end, no becoming is really worth it. Even the becoming in the name of Dharma. And that in the end you drop that as well. And just this famous phrase, famous image in the text of the raft, Rafsoda. So when you got to the other side of the river, you just don't need it anymore. And you can let it go. That's with becoming. So it's okay to, I want to be a Buddhist practitioner, I want to go to, and I desire it, and I need it, and I'm pushing for it. All those things we just talked about, which is sort of ki'ilu negative. It's okay. But slowly, slowly, we know we can drop them. And then the path takes us. And we don't need to feel we're pushing at all. We are just with it. It's with us. There's no need to for pushing, desiring, attachment to being a Buddhist. We need to recognize the basic problem with our craving to become somebody is not only that it's painful, actually the pain helps us. Because when we see that it produces painful results, this is our wake-up call. If we see that the selfing makes suffering for ourselves and others, it's a wake-up for us. It can, if we're ready to listen. If we're not ready to listen, we just cause hell to ourselves and everybody around us. But if we're ready to listen, then dukkha is a teacher for us. And that's why it's there as the first noble truth. It's the noble truth of the path. Helps us become noble. First noble truth. It's not that the truth is noble, it makes us noble. And that's because dukkha, when we know it, is a kind of springboard, keresh kpitsa, to the path. And it always, if we're in doubt and we see pain, and we know we experienced at subtly looking and seeing pain when it's there, this is our guide. It guides us to a place where we need to work, or we need to understand something, or we need to clarify something, or we need to practice. So it's always for us like the guide in the desert, dukkha, pain. But the main problem with this selfing and the craving and the creation of the selfing is it's just simply not true. that it leads us to a place of, just like the nun said, what makes you assume there is a being? We're just a pile of constructions, and it's unstable. Constructions that are coming and going. We're just a pile of molecules. Carbon, Pachman, Chamtzan, that's what we are. Making a big deal of ourselves. We're just a pile of Pachman walking about on the planet giving trouble to everybody. And it's all unstable. It goes back. It goes back. It all returns. It's a pile that's all the time in dynamic relationship with everything else. We make a big deal because we think we're a thing. We're not a thing. We're a relationship. So the problem with it is it's basically untruth. And so we're living in an untruth. And we can only keep this untruth by a lot of energy our whole life, of closing ourselves, protecting ourselves. And so the Buddha kept saying one of the most important little one-liners in the whole Buddhist teaching is that all compounded things are unstable, are painful, and have no permanent self. anicca, dukkha, anatta, all compounded things. That means everything, but that means everything. Because everything is compounded, meaning compounded, how do you say in Hebrew? Murkav. Everything is murkav. Can you think of one thing that is not made of other things? There isn't one thing that is not made of other things. So everything is made of everything else. And all compounded things, fabricated things, are unstable, they fall to pieces, they are painful because they do that, and they have no permanent self. And the interesting thing is, there's no permanent not self. Now, you go home and think about that one. It non-self, there's no permanent self, and there's no permanent non-self either. In other words, even when you try and say non-self, you're in a territory which is untrue. Because where is non-self? What is non-self? What is self? What is non-self? Everything is interacting with everything else. So where is self and where is non-self? I'll come back to that. But our practice is to really get in there quick. In a moment of experience, just get in there fast. Before, if we can, before the building of a self happens as a result of craving and attachment. We have the tools for this. Mindfulness is good enough. Mindfulness, steadiness, concentration, quiet, these are our tools. They're good enough. There's a beautiful story in the tradition about that the self is like a king in a castle. And he thinks he's king of everything, but actually he's in a castle with very thick walls, and he's suffering, because although he thinks he's got a kingdom somewhere, he's actually miserable inside thick walls of his castle. And so he's pacing up and down, and there's a window high up, and the window is open, and a little bird flies in, and the little bird comes and brings him a message. And the message is in the two wings of the bird, and one is mindfulness, and the other one is samadhi, steadiness, concentration, silence, and it brings relief. So it kind of nice image, like there's a bird coming in that says, you know, you have a way out of this, there's a message of your freedom. It's through a small window. It may just seem a small window. We may seem lots of walls. We may seem inside. But there's a small window. And a bird coming in saying, "Mind, be mindful, it's okay." So, get in there quickly, seeing the nature of experience before, in a way, it builds into a story. And when it builds into story, also get in there quickly and see the building of story and the building of self. Just try and sort of be right in there, in the immediate experience. And there is where the thing can't stand anymore. It just can't stand, because it needs ignorance. It's not true. Therefore it needs ignorance. It needs non-wisdom to sustain itself. So the minute we shine the light on these things, they crumble to pieces. They fall to pieces. The minute we shine a light on the self, on the selfing, which we think is true, we begin to see it falls to pieces. Where is it finishing? Where is it ending? Where is it starting? Where is it? It's pieces. So it's just, there's an untruth there, but if we shine the light on it, we will see it. And so our mindfulness is our light. And we see that things just come. to be. They just arise. Things arise. A thought, an impression, a sound, sound of the radio today, taste of food, just arriving. And things then also stopping. End of a thought, end of the radio, end of supper. So things arising and dying away, arising and dying away. And that kind of that truth gradually eats away at the illusion of the permanent self. It's not that it's not an experience of a subject. There is. We are experiencing, truthfully, a sense of a subject. Subject. It's true experience, not a lie. We experience a subject. But that doesn't mean to say that it exists as a thing that is permanent. It's just an experience. Therefore, just a construction. Therefore, made up of other things, like every experience. Made up of murkav. So, we look at it. The self is murkav. It's made up of many things. And then we can't take the self so seriously if we see it's made up of so many things. It's just constantly making and disappearing and appearing and as we said before, things then die away, they disappear, because we don't sustain it. We don't keep giving fire, giving fuel, upadana, fuel. We don't keep feeding the fire. By seeing it, it's enough. When Mara is constantly seen, that's all you need to do with Mara. Mara, you don't need to fight him, you don't need to stop him, you don't need to do anything with him. As soon as you see Mara, he kind of collapses, becomes baby Mara, and kind of wanders off. That's what it says, he wanders off. Then Mara, the evil one, evil being, became sad and miserable and said, "Oh, Vajira, the nun, she knows me." And then he disappeared. All you have to do is know it. You don't need to do anything with it. You just have to see it. Seeing is enough. It's subtle. Because we think we still have a habit of thinking we need to deal with everything. We need to deal with our problems. We need to deal with our psychological issues. We need to deal with our wounds and our scars, our tzalakot, tzalakot fizi, tzalakot psikologi. We just think we need to deal with. But truth is, Mara just needs to be seen. And by seeing, constantly seeing, it happens by itself. That fuel, the fueling of the fire through ignorance, is the fuel is dried up, is used up, no more fuel. So we starve the problems of our attachment, and then they fall away. The whole territory of the self and the selfing and the creation of self and so on is very, very problematic for us to understand in any logical way. And those of you, many times in the groups over the last two or three days, people said, "I don't understand, it's very confusing, I'm lost in this, I can't understand what's going on, it doesn't." And that really is the best place to be. The sense of not knowing is actually iidia, is actually quite a healthy place from which to see things, to seek even. Means not defining, not identifying. And remember, all the boundaries between self and the other are ki'ilu, things that we identify. Non-identification and non-separation can be confusing, because we're so used to, the mind is so used to dividing everything, into pieces. So there's another knowing that comes, and it's partly a knowing that we're practicing here. We're not really practicing intellectual. It may be thoughts and tovanot and understandings, fine, but we're not really in that territory. We're a territory where something is changing in the consciousness itself, and we find ourselves in another place, and that other place is called wisdom. And the wisdom is a seeing which is inclusive, a seeing which is beyond the boundaries or the limits, a seeing which is about interconnection with everything, a seeing which includes all possibilities. So it's a very different kind of knowing. And on the way, we may feel confused and lost. Especially in this retreat, when we're talking about all of these things. You know, the other, maybe if you feel really confused, go to the other one. There it's a lot simpler, I can tell you. Follow the breath, walk, you know, next day, hindrances, next day. You know, just here we're in a little bit, we're cooking ourselves in a soup of... But like the famous Zen phrase, little doubt, little enlightenment. Middle doubt, middle enlightenment. Great doubt, great enlightenment. It is a place of idea, of not knowing. But that's a wisdom. It's a place of, I would say, just awareness that sees in the nature of things as they really are, and not the game that we're all playing of illusion. The dream that we all live in, the consensus dream that we all agree on through maybe thousands of lives, and certainly this one, certainly all our parents told us a certain story, and we all agree on it. And we all went to school to learn it. Nagarjuna. Many of you may have heard of Nagarjuna, who was a 4th century Buddhist teacher in Varanasi, I think. And he wrote a book full of poems. And the poems were really about just this place of you can't say that and you can't say that. And so the truth is not so definable. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this. There is no self, but there is no self. There is not this, not that, not that. So where do you go? You fall between... Bena kisaot, actually, which is not a bad place to be. I prefer the image of a trapeze, that you let go of one trapeze and you didn't quite get to the next one yet. And so you're in the middle. Where's the safety net? So I just want to quote to you a little bit of Nagarjuna that gives a sense of the not knowing, or the mystery, or the non-linear and the non-intellectual way that we can look at reality and find a deeper truth than the illusion or the dream that we live in. A poem called Life. So these are free translations by Stephen Batchelor. Okay. When I cannot be found inside this body or this mind, who is there to be alive? If I survived by hope, by clinging, by craving to thoughts and feelings, how could I change? Without clinging or changing, who can be alive? If I came and went, how could I be freed? How could I, this I, which disappears, comes and goes, how could it be free? Be freed. In other words, who's practicing to be free if the I is coming and going? Neither tied nor untied are free. Where if the tied could be freed, freedom and tying would be the same thing. I am free, I tie, I am holding no more, liberation is mine. The greatest holding on is to hold on like that. What do you think of a freedom that never happens? What do you make of a life that won't go away? A poem called Self. What is inside is me. What is outside is mine. When these thoughts end, craving stops, repetition, papancha, stops, and freedom arises. Fixations, also a word for craving or fixing, sankharas actually, so formations you could say, breed thoughts. They provoke automatic acts. Emptiness stops formations. Buddhas do speak of self, and they also teach no self, but they also say there's nothing which is either self or no self. It is all at ease in Ninoach. It is unable to be fixed, unfixatable by fixations. You can't communicate it. You can't conceive it. You can't divide it. You are not the same as or different from the conditions on which you depend. You are neither separate from them nor forever stuck to them. If mind and body were me, I would come and go like them. But if I were something else, they would say nothing about me. I'll say it again. If mind and body were me, I would come and go with them. In other words, when I went to the hairdresser, the barber, and he took some hair and threw it in the rubbish bin, I would say, "Hey, stop, it's me." Because mind and body is, so if mind and body are not me, right? If mind and body were me, I would come and go with them. I would be thrown in the rubbish bin with my hair. Or in the toilet, there would be me going into the biyu. So I'm not mind and body, clearly. But I'm not something else. Because if I was something else, then mind and body wouldn't be able, he says, would say nothing about me, wouldn't be not relevant to me. I would look at the mind and body, have no connection to it. So I am connected to it. But clearly mind and body is not me. So it's an example of the paradox in all of this. The difficulty of trying to work it out logically. We need another wisdom. And all we've got is what I said, the mindfulness, the curiosity, the interest, the inquiry into what is this construction called, this thing that we made, called the me. What is this thing? How it comes and goes. When the Buddha was awakened, he said, "I have destroyed the rafters, the korot gag of the building. It will never be built again." In other words, he destroyed this constant construction, sankharas, of being a self, of needing and turning into a self, and agreeing to be a self, and agreeing with everybody that we are like this. I've finished with it. He said, it's the first thing he said. It's done. This house cannot be built anymore. This house of illusion, Ashlaya. So finally, just the word, it's much easier for us if we just allow ourselves to see that we are made from conditions. Conditions are endless and changing, tna'im. They make us and they make the self. We ourselves make other conditions. We make conditions for our next moment. We are a condition. Stephen is a condition for the Stephen that appears in the next minute. I am a condition for the next me. This breath is a condition for the next breath. This moment is conditions, hatnaya, is making the next moment. We're all the time in a sea of conditions. And we don't have a choice, we can just dance with it. Let go and dance with conditions. Let them come, let them go, including the ones that make apparently a me. No problem. If you're not believing in the me, it's no problem. It's conditions that make a response. The selfing is a response. It's okay. I don't have a problem that I've got this shape and this voice and this kind of inability to learn Hebrew. It's just a shape. It's just the way it is. It's conditions that make things like they are. Conditions will kill me. It's okay. I'll turn into something else. Go back to carbon, will go back to carbon. Pachman will go back to Pachman. Everything goes home. That's fine. Make a new something. So we just dance. We let go into that. We just let go into conditions. Let conditions form us, shape us, break us. And there's a truth in that. We can just let go. We just let go. We just relax. Let it take us. Thank you.